Great. Welcome, everyone, to the Football Scholars Forum. We are joined by Igabo Chipande here in East Lansing, where Liz Timms is also in attendance, and several others online. We've got Chris Boltzmann, Chris Henderson, Chris Brown, Andrew Guest, Daniel Reich, and Martha Saavedra. We've got people in various continents, from North America to South America to Western Asia, as I like to call it. And it's a real pleasure to introduce Igabo Chipande to you. He's finishing his PhD here at Michigan State University in African History. And you all read his paper, Mining for Gold, Football and Social Change on the Zambian Copper Belt, 1940s to 1960s. And without further ado, I'll pass the ball over to Igabo.
Thank you very much for giving me this good opportunity to share my work on football on the Zambian Copper Belt. As Professor Aleji has indicated, I'm a PhD candidate in African history here at Michigan State University, and I'm actually supervised by him in my PhD dissertation. So this paper you read is a part of my larger doctoral project, focusing on the political and social history of football or soccer in Zambia from the 1940s to the mid-1990s. It is a shortened version of my chapter one out of the seven content chapters in my dissertation. So maybe for the benefit of those that might not be very familiar with the history of Zambia, it might be important for me to say a few words about the Copper Belt, which is the area that I'm discussing in this paper. The British South African Company, a company founded by John Rhodes, occupied and started colonizing this area called Zambia from the late 1890s and named it after Rhodes himself as Northern Rhodesia, with Zimbabwe being called Southern Rhodesia on the southern end. So around the same time, small-scale mining activities were already going on in the northwestern part of Northern Rhodesia that bordered the Katanga region of Belgium, Congo. And this is the area that came to be called the Copper Belt. So the British South African Company rule of Northern Rhodesia came to an end in 1924. When the British realized that the company was not doing a very good job. So the territory fell under the British Colonial Office in 1924. And the following year, 1925, rich underground deposits of copper ore were discovered in this area I mentioned that came to be called the Copper Belt. So this brought rapid industrialization and related developments that led to the emergence of six mining towns within a very small area and drove large numbers of people to seek jobs in the mines. So by the 1940s, where my study begins, the Copper Belt had emerged as one of the most concentrated large-scale mining industries in sub-Saharan Africa. Mining compounds housed over 250,000 African miners coming from different parts of the region. And in this case, the miners were not only coming from within Northern Rhodesia, but they were also coming from, you know, the neighboring regions such as Katanga in Belgium, Congo, which had already been mining copper for a very long time. Others were coming from Tanganyika, which is Tanzania today, from Nyasaland, which is Malawi, and others from across the Zambezi River in Southern Rhodesia, which is called Zimbabwe today. So this huge number of heterogeneous people in one small area played an important role in shaping political, economic, and social change within this whole region. So the Copper Belt became a hub for labor and nationalist movements, and also sports activities, particularly football in this case. As the mining industries were emerging in 1938, the British government actually sponsored the establishment of the Rhodes Livingstone Institute, which was the first social science research institute in Africa to study the local people in northern Rhodesia in relationship to these massive mining investments that were going on the Copper Belt. So a lot of Rhodes Livingstone Institute-inspired related scholarship emerged, exploring, you know, urbanization, because a lot of people were leaving all the rural areas to seek jobs in the mining towns on the Copper Belt. But none of this scholarship paid any attention to football, which was the most popular leisure activity in the mining towns. So this is what kind of, you know, inspired me to write this chapter or this paper on football on the Copper Belt. And in terms of sources, I spent about 18 months in Zambia conducting archival research in the National Archives of Zambia, the Mining and Industrial Archive on the Copper Belt in Ndola. The National Archives of Zambia, I'm sorry, is in Lusaka, the capital, and the Mining and Industrial Archive is on the Copper Belt. And I also conducted over 60 oral interviews with football players like Ginger Pensulo, whom I mentioned in the introduction of the paper. I also interviewed former football officials, administrators, and fans. So these are the sources that helped me to discuss how urbanized Africans appropriated the game from the British, how colonial and mining capital wanted to use the game to control African miners, and how later Africans used the game to challenge authorities, build new urban networks, and turn the game into an urban popular culture in the mining towns. And since most of us have read the article, so I'll end here and wait to hear from you, your views and questions.
Great. Thank you, Rigabo. Who would like to ask the first question?
I have a question.
Who is that?
This is Alex.
Alex, okay, shoot.
Chipande, could you give us as best of an explanation as you can as the changing relationship that I pick up on in your paper about where the clubs are actually located inside of other institutions? Because one of the really fascinating things that you talk about is how the landscape changes from teams being organized inside of welfare institutions, then becoming more ethnically bounded and sometimes attached to companies. I wasn't sure if there was a clear sense in the paper of when these clubs become clubs in and of their own rights, and how you even think about what makes a club be autonomous from the welfare institute or the company at different times. Could you just explain that in a little bit more detail to help me wrap my head around it?
Sure. Thank you, Alex, for a very good question. As I try to discuss in the paper, initially, actually, when the African miners appropriated the game from the British, they were playing the game in their own communities. They organized their own football teams in ethnic lines. Since most of them were coming from different parts of different regions and different parts, so they were, as I indicate in the paper, there were teams that were named, for example, Tanganyika, made up of, you know, people from, you know, the Tanganyika region or Tanzania, Nyasa, people from Nyasaland, Ebisa, you know, teams related to ethnic groups. So after the Second World War, then as I discuss in the paper, when the colonial and mining authorities realized that probably there was need, because, you know, in the 1940s, there were what were 1935 and 1940, there are what were called the Copper Belt strikes that are caused by a number of factors. And then after all these issues, then the mining and colonial authorities felt that probably there was need to take an ideological approach to, you know, to colonialism than just, you know, controlling and pushing urbanized Africans in their compounds. So this is when now the mining, the warfare activities emerged and were intensified. And now part of the warfare activities tended to try to bring together these ethnic teams to play in, group them and play in the sections within the mining compounds that they were confined in. And this kind of gradually started drifting the teams, the football teams, from being ethnic, you know, connected to move towards, you know, playing for warfare sections, etc. But then towards the end of the 1940s and the beginning of the 1950s, then major mining towns on the Copper Belt then kind of moved towards supporting powerful or big football clubs within their mining town. So they selected the best players from within these ethnic and welfare teams and made kind of organized non-ethnic football teams, which they started sponsoring somehow and supporting in a way, halfway, not full, where they would provide, for example, transport, as I discussed how, for example, Dixon Makwaza would get in the paper, how I discussed the one of the players would was explaining how he would be offered transport from the mining shaft to the football ground, but nothing more than that. And the rest, the clubs kind of sorted out themselves. So here, gradually, I would say from the 1950s, drifting towards the end of the 1950s, going to the 1960s, the teams were almost semi-autonomous. And then moving towards the 1960s, then the mines kind of moved in with full force to try kind of and support the clubs, and the clubs then became kind of an identity of each mining town. And then this brought kind of a competition between the different mining towns or districts as to which one has the best team. And the personnel managers in each mine then were tasked to organize the football clubs and even kind of enticing football players from other clubs to get the best, to make sure that they get the rim light within the mining towns as the best footballing footballing club or the best footballing mine. So I'm not sure if I touched on the question that you asked, Alex.
No, it's perfect. You gave me a much better sense of how the trajectory of what a club is and what defines it changes over time. That was kind of what most struck me. It's very different from what I look at in Argentina, as one club being founded at the start of the century with a fairly defined relation to its community, to the state, to what it means to be a part of that club. And it seems like a much more complex picture that's going on in Zambia. So thanks for the paper too. It's fantastic, Chipan. It's great to see it all coming together for you.
Sure. No, thanks, Alex.
And here we're talking about amateur football, legally speaking, right? There is a semi-professional league that develops later on, and those are yet different types of clubs, also racially mixed and so on. But the next question is from Chris Boltzmann and then Daniel.
Hello, everybody. Hi, Hikabwe. I really liked your paper, a fantastic read, and I really look forward to reading the completed thesis. I have a few questions, but I'll ask one, if I may. I'll ask one question now, and that is, you refer to academic researchers, and in particular the Rhodes Livingston Institute, and the fact that none of these academics, these researchers, many of them Brits or British researchers, considered sport and football in particular. Can you possibly expand on that and maybe suggest why that was the case? Had it to do with possibly class location of these researchers or sporting preferences, etc.? Thanks.
Sure. Thank you very much for a very good question. So the Rhodes Livingston Institute actually was predominantly, as you have indicated, run by British anthropologists with a number of American anthropologists as well later joining. So their main focus around that time was to study the local people and see as to how they are going to relate and work with, you know, the British investors in the mines. So then the major scholarship, kind of the major works that emerged out of the Rhodes Livingstone Institute, especially pertaining to the Copper Belt, was kind of, you know, urban anthropological studies that focused on, you know, how the urbanized Africans kind of, in a way, according to anthropologists, were becoming modernized or were becoming urbanized and changed from their traditional activities to modern activities within within the mining towns. So mainly the focus was a huge scholarship emerged predominantly focusing on urbanization. It became a very big discussion, which continued, I mean, up to, which has continued up to now, I must say, with, you know, James Ferguson's expectations of modernity and building on the same, you know, paradigms or discussions that were raised by these Rhodes Livingstone Institute anthropologists. So most of them immersed themselves in looking at how Africans were getting urbanized, and the political relations between racial and political relations within the mining towns. And one important work that was done by one anthropologist, Hortense Powdermaker, in Luanshya. She's Professor Leji actually has the book with him here. She was amongst all those scholars. She's basically the only one who paid attention to leisure studies on the Copper Belt, where she conducted her ethnographic research in Luanshya, looking at radio, listening to radio, and the various a number of other leisure activities that urbanized miners were venturing into in the Copper Belt. And then she mentions actually that football or soccer was one of the most popular activity that the Africans played during their leisure time in the mining towns. So basically, I think most of them drifted towards mostly these contentious issues of race and labor relations, and very few of them paid attention to leisure. Only Hortense Powdermaker so far, and this was later on followed by, you know, historian Charles Ambler, who wrote a few two articles on leisure in Zambia, and particularly on the mining towns on the Copper Belt. I'm not sure if I answered the question or if I got it right. Well,
why is it? I think Chris was asking that.
Yes.
Was there a class issue? Were these anthropologists or upper class elites who didn't pay attention to football? Maybe Powdermaker didn't fit that profile, or maybe because she was American. What do you think? Gluckman had a deep interest in football.
Yes, he had. Yes.
I mean, he forced his graduate students in Manchester to go to Old Trafford.
I'm told
he
so.
He literally coerced them.
Yes.
So there's something there that I think Chris is getting at. What do you think?
My take is that actually, what is class could have been there, but. Most of the works done by, I think, primarily out the works of the anthropologists whom I've read, I think they basically most of them drifted towards their areas of interest. But looking at in terms of class, most of them actually identified, whilst of course some scholars, you know, accused them of being, you know, agents of the colonialists. But when I look at most of their works, they risk their lives to do research in African communities when they were discouraged and with the disapprovals of the mining and colonial authorities. So I feel that the reason could have been that there was just a lot for them to look at, and they mostly drifted towards more contentious issues of race, the strikes that were going on, racial relations and labor relations. It was only Paul Damaka who paid attention to leisure, but class issues, not really. I don't think so. I see Rhodes Livingstone Institute anthropologists, particularly the generations of those anthropologists that did works on the Copper Belt. They actually identified themselves with the Africans, and they to some extent put their lives in danger to explore and interact with the Africans. Or with the local people in the mining townships, yes.
Okay, thank you. Daniel, your next question. And Martha is also pointing out on the chat function here that Elizabeth Colson from Berkeley was involved there too, of course, and she will follow Daniel's question. Okay, so let's pass it over to Beirut.
First of all, I also would like to force my graduate students to go to football matches, because unfortunately they prefer watching Premier League on TV than watching local soccer matches. But coming to my question, first of all, thanks for the interesting paper, which I really enjoyed reading. Two questions. I saw on the website that your research is funded by the FIFA Havelange Research Scholarship. This is certainly the worst name for a scholarship, given Havelange history. But could you tell us a little bit about this scholarship, about the process to receive it, the requirements, and just a little bit background on the scholarship? And my second question, since I'm not a historian, I would like to know, you're talking about like the popularity of football in Copperbelt, but if I look the overall picture, Zambia is not successful in football. They never qualified for a World Cup. Are there any historic reasons for this lack of success that from your research you could tell us about?
Sure, thank you very much for the interesting questions. The first one on the FIFA Joao Havelange research scholarship. And on this one, my colleague Alex, I'm sure would also come in to help me in terms of explaining the process. Because actually he played an important role in encouraging me, and I consulted him a lot when I was going through the whole process. So basically, I felt that it was just an open process where you just go to their website. I went to their website, and of course... Alex tipped me about it after I applied, after he had received his scholarship. So I just went through the process and filled the application form and write a motivation and sent it to them. It was pretty straightforward, and the following, they give a period, I think they respond. If you, the deadline is somewhere around September, October, if I can remember. And when you submit the application, then they respond you in the beginning of the year, the following year, which is in this case in January, February. So... they responded and indicated that they liked my application and they were going to offer me the scholarship. So it was, I really appreciated it. Of course, despite all the names that are associated, all the issues that are associated with FIFA. But I really appreciated and enjoyed, appreciated the scholarship, because it helped me to stay a lot longer conducting my research in Zambia. And it is one scholarship, actually, that had very few strings attached. You know, they give an outline on how they disperse the finances. You can apply, actually, up to 30,000 US dollars. But then I was a bit...
shy.
Yeah, shy to ask for more. I thought, wow, since I desperately needed the money for research, so I thought, wow, let me just ask for a little. And I asked for 12,000 and they gave it to me right away. So this
was not for like a salary. This was more to finance a field work in Zambia, right?
That's correct. Yes, that's right. Just to finance field work in Zambia. And then they break it down. They give you in four
branches.
Yes, in four segments. And when they just approve your scholarship, then you let them know when you want the first amount. Then they send it to your account. And after you submit your first report, then they send the second disbursement and the last one after you send the last report. Mm-hmm. So maybe I would ask my colleague Alex to maybe shed more light on it. I might have left something very important.
You pretty much covered it. Did you have anything and anything else in particular, Daniel, that you were wondering about?
No, it was very. I mean, how complex was the application? I mean,
they give you room. They give you room to work through what you're doing. There's clear sections on methodology and context for the project. But I believe you get around 8 pages to really explain yourself. It was a different experience for me writing my fieldwork grant for the Fulbright, which is a much shorter application. So it was useful to have the FIFA application, and that I got to explain a little bit more to a different kind of audience as well, given the FIFA research agenda. So my impression of the scholarship, which is just an impression, because really the only insight you ever get is what's on the website. Your very kind of direct formal communication with the person dispersing the funds at FIFA, and then anecdotes from the other people that, you know, I've won it, but it's quite open. You know, they don't release how many people get it or the amounts that they give, how many are available. So it's a little bit of a black box, but I know many people who've applied and quite a few have gotten it. It's also, it can be a collaborative, grant. So I know some of the research that initially guided me in Argentina was funded by the Avalanche Scholarship as well, to a group of four sociologists and historians in Argentina. Mm-hmm. So it's a nice thing that's out there in the world that a lot of people have benefited from. So
yeah,
unfortunate name, but good.
Yeah, if I
maybe,
could just
maybe you can answer the second question. Yeah.
Oh, the second question about the international performance of Zambia and the reason.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yes, that's a very good question. Zambia has, a very long tradition of playing football. As I indicate, as early as the mid 1920s, local people were already, you know, absorbed and immersed in the game. But a number of factors, I think, are play for. I explain why probably Zambia has failed to make it to the World Cup. Relatively, and in terms of the regional and African context, I think the Zambians see themselves as very successful, a very successful team, or a very successful at an international level, as in the region rather. They see themselves as very successful in football compared to the neighboring nations, for example. In the region, south of the equator in Africa, they see themselves as quite a very competitive country, actually. But a number of factors play probably as to why they are not doing a lot better from my point of view. And some of them could be, One major one could be resources. Apart from I discuss in my other chapters from the 1960s when the country just got independence and there was massive investment in the economy was doing well, the copper prices were very high, and the economy was flourishing. So there was a lot of investment in football, and there was a lot of political will. The first president himself, President Kaunda, he was a football fan and a former football player, and he went out of his way to push parastatal corporations to sponsor and support grassroots and club football development. So the game, I feel, he laid the foundation that made Zambia kind of a fairly competitive football country in the region. But then there, after the fall of the copper prices at the international market, as the whole backbone of the Zambian economy was copper, and then there was, the catastrophic fall that James Ferguson explains very well in his book. And then that meant that, the country had to start prioritizing where to put their resources in terms of health, agriculture, and food security. So I think primarily those factors played a role or could still be playing a role as to why the country is not as competitive probably as other West African African nations or North African nations. And also, to some extent, later on, football politics, leadership, the kinds of leaders that get into the people that get into football leadership, probably they don't have long-term plans, grassroots development, and all those factors, I think, come in. But as I mentioned, the Zambians themselves, I think they see themselves as relatively successful footballing nation in the region, because of course they compare themselves to their neighbors, and I know Andrew Guest is listening. We compare ourselves to Malawi, for example, so we feel we are doing a little better.
And also, we should point out that as an Italian, I must remember with great pain the Zambian destruction of Italy at the 1988 Olympics, 4-0, one of the most famous victories of Zambia. But it is true, one of the rare successes outside of Africa. But also, Zambia won the African Nations Cup just 3 years ago.
Yes.
So there have been some victories, but I'm glad you contextualized them so well. You have a follow-up before we go to Martha.
Yes, just to follow up on what Professor Aleji has mentioned, following, that 1988 Olympics performance, then thereafter, in 1993, the entire national team, Zambia national football team, perished off the coast of Gabon in Libreville.
Yes.
And kind of the Zambians feel that, a generation of very talented or the most talented football players they've ever had perished in Gabon. And they were actually on the verge of qualifying to the 1994 World Cup in America. Mm-hmm. And they were definitely going to qualify, no doubt about it. But, all those events kind of played into, and that is around the time when the economy was also going nose down and collapsing.
Mm-hmm. Yes, very, very sad occasion, 1993. There's a recent film, by the way, on this. I'm tweeting, as are others, at the hashtag FSF Zambia, so there's a back-channel conversation happening there, too. But over to Berkeley and Martha now.
Okay, so I'm not going to ask the women question, although we can put that out there, any evidence of women, but the two questions I had, one was, I think it's very clear just how important football was. And, it is kind of a contrast. Well, all these researchers didn't even look at it. Well, it does seem to be very, very important. But I think sometimes you know, and I just got back a manuscript from something else, and, you know, like the reviewers, they're very skeptical of sports studies and things. And I'm wondering, is there a way to sort of really situate to people who aren't already convinced or just really need to, or it's good to know the magnitude of the importance of football? And if, you know, maybe it's comparatively, you mentioned that there were some other sports. And so, you know, relative to other sports, is there, do you have numbers or ways of showing, you know, how important football was? And also, you know, you give some numbers about the numbers of fans and the numbers of players and things, but relative to the population as a whole and maybe over time, and if there's any changes in like the popularity or the participation in football over time. So I guess I'm, you know, I mean, I'm convinced, but I am like in a way wanting to show other people, hey, you know, this really is this very, you know, critically important area. But I think you also have a very interesting story in Zambia and some of the material on the different, as like with the first question of the different ways that these football clubs were with the communities, with the welfare committees, with the companies. So, I mean, there's a lot of things. But so the magnitude and comparative importance, that's one question. And then maybe in other chapters, I'm also interested in that more, you know, you have a couple of quotes from players and other people. And if in your dissertation that you get into that real experiential, you know, the individuals coming to it and what it meant to them. And so maybe that could play into the first question of mine. But I'm assuming that you probably later on have a lot more of that kind of material in your dissertation. And I'm just wondering if you could signal that or just mention that, talk about that.
Yes, sure. Thank you very much. I'll touch a bit on the issue of women before I get to the other questions that you mentioned. Yes, as I somehow indicate in the paper, the from the 1940s to the late 1950s and the late 1960s up to independence in 1964, for whatever reasons, sorry for that. Women are not prominently featuring in these football clubs. From the interviews that I had with, you know, former football administrators and soccer fans, leaders of fans groups, they indicated that, you know, around this time, you know, women mostly were drifting towards playing netball. They would, of course, they showed interest if the game was played in open spaces or, you know, in communities. They would definitely be there to cheer and support their sons, brothers, etc. But they are not members of these fans groups, which because these fans group in the 50s and the 40s and 50s, kind of, it was a very kind of a masculine environment where the miners extended kind of, you know, the mining, the underground mining atmosphere, and those cohorts then are the ones that kind of grouped themselves and made fans groups and went to watch football matches in the stadiums. And the few women that were showing up, according to the sources that I got, were those that were either, you know, friends of top, you know, management officials, and those probably that were working for the mines and were involved in the running of activities at the stadiums. So, but then the situation changed as we gain independence, meaning because I'm Zambian, so as the Zambians gain independence in 1964, suddenly women start showing up in football grounds, and I discuss this at length in other chapters that I write in my dissertation. They actually get even to play central roles in supporters' groups and even the running of the game. With later in the 80s, some women even becoming a leading or becoming national chairperson of, you know, of the fans supporters or soccer fans supporters association. So that is a little bit about women. And later on, of course, in the other chapters, the later periods, I also discuss how women got into playing the game and even forming a Zambian Women Football League. Coming to the second question, in Zambia, of course, the importance of the game is not debated. I mean, many people, almost all the people in Zambia know that, naturally know that the game is, football is the most popular sport compared to other sports such as, you know, athletics, women's netball, which is predominantly a British sport. I'm sure some people might not be familiar with it. So in Zambia, the sports landscape is that there's football, which is the most dominant sport. I mean, when you talk about sport anywhere in Zambia, so are you a football coach? Or, you know, they'll definitely relate you to football. So in terms of other sports, then there's athletics, that is quite there, but not as dominating as football. Then there's netball, volleyball, and a few other sports like basketball that are very, very, very minor. And government, of course, I discussed this in my other chapters, where the post-colonial government kind of take over where the colonial take over where the British end in terms of wanting to use football as a tool for controlling people. So they take over as well, and as a result, they invest a lot in football. And football become actually after independence, football become key even to politics, where politicians feel if the fans feel that, you know, the game is not well supported, then they will lose elections and they will do everything they can. And this has continued even now. So, but then when it comes to academic scholarship in the Zambian context, for example, of course, you know, like anthropologist Bia Vidas argues that, you know, the African continent has a lot of contentious or issues that kind of people can pay attention to, such as, you know, the economy, you know, the genocides that go on, hunger or starvations, and which scholars, which attract a lot of attention from scholars. And of course, a number of people also, like my colleagues, sometimes when I raise my head in Zambia and say, no, I'm studying football, then they would wonder, you went to the US and you're studying football, why are you not studying economics or, you know, agriculture science or something of that sort? So, because traditionally, of course, locally as well, they see it as, I mentioned this in one of my chapters, where they kind of relate it to play and something play then is unserious and it's not something that is worth paying a lot of attention to. So, in the other chapters that I write in my dissertation, I kind of try to justify the importance of the game and how actually the central role or an important role it plays in the lives of the people. So I'm not sure if I really answered your question. I would be happy to touch on it on specifics if there's anything more that I need to touch on.
I think it sounds like the rest of your dissertation is going to really be good. So
I hope so.
Yeah, we'll see about that.
Yeah.
Chris Brown, then Chris Henderson.
Okay, thanks. I was going to ask a question about sources, and we often use newspaper sources, fanzines, that kind of thing, as primary sources. And also we know how football develops with a connection between a press, administrators, clubs, and government, etc. So I was wondering if you could talk a bit about that. Was there a sporting press operating in your area? I notice you have a few references to something called Mutende from 1937, and I was wondering if you could talk about that a bit.
Sure, thank you. Yes, as you have correctly kind of pointed out, newspaper has played an important role. I mean, where part of my main sources in my whole study, and there were newspapers such as the Mutende. The Mutende was a very interesting newspaper because it was actually run by the colonial government, but for Africans. Because there are other newspapers such as the Northern News, the Central African Post, and many others that kind of were focusing on, you know, on the European communities and their football. A lot of news in the Northern News about football activities for, you know, a flourishing Northern Rhodesia Football League, of course, a racially segregated league made up of European colonial industrialists and investors. So, but the Mtende was primarily focusing on African activities, and although, of course, it was run by the colonial government. But then, in various mining towns or districts, because there are about 6 to 7 mining towns, and they turned out to be districts themselves. So each district had a newsletter, which was kind of a magazine, like, you know, the Nchanga News, where they would write details of Asia activities taking place in African communities, and football was one of the major activities that was covered, one of the leisure activities that was covered in the mining news bulletins or weekly newsletters that were coming out. So these were also segregated. There were those that focused primarily on European communities and the news, the newspapers or magazines that focused on African communities. But there were no, I did not come across any specific newspapers that focus only on sports. So it would be a magazine or a newspaper in the colonial era focusing on Africans in a particular mining town. It brings out all aspects of, you know, of their lives, such as, you know, the mining activities, Asia activities, etc. And those were very, very useful in terms of giving an idea of what was going on in different mining towns and in African communities. So apart from that, as I indicated, I spent quite some time in the Mining and Industrial Archive, which is located in Ndola on the Copper Belt. And the mines were very, very organized in terms of reporting. So from the 1940s, when these major teams became part, or when the mines started supporting the big teams in their mining towns, so records of, you know, minutes, club minutes, reports, budgets, etc., were all kind of considered as mine property and were taken to this, it used to be called Zambia Consolidated Copper Mines Archive. Now it changed to the Mining and Industrial Archive. So all those reports, mining reports, played an important role, were a very useful source. And then in these, each mining compound had a welfare manager or welfare officer who also wrote quite welfare reports that included leisure in terms of dances, football activities, you know, and other leisure activities that took place. So I also looked into those reports. They played a very they were very useful in terms of giving an idea of what was going on in each mining compound. And then I spent quite some time also interviewing former football administrators, players, etc., etc., and as I mentioned earlier, officials who kind of actually played a role in running clubs, playing like Ginger Pencil, whom I mentioned in the introduction of the article.
Okay, thank you. Chris Henderson.
Hi. So thank you for the piece. It's really wonderful, and I'm looking forward to the full draft. My interest is in the supporter clubs that you touch on at the end of this piece. First, I'd like to know what the structure of the clubs themselves is. Are they democratic structures, or are they, you know, structured in a different way? And then I'm particularly interested if the supporter clubs are able to sort of, you know, you talk about their power within the sport to affect, you know, sort of team policies and play on the field. But is there any step to take the organization of fans and then move to the sort of wider political, social movements that go on within the country?
Sure, thank you. That's a good question, yeah. Yes, they were, as they started emerging, the supporters clubs kind of, you know, were very democratic. I give an example of this man who was just kind of selling tea to miners on their way to their underground shafts and who engaged the miners every day when they know, how do you know yesterday? No, we are, how did we perform this weekend? What do you think about our, you know, what do you think about this new player? You know, so out of that, you know, enthusiasm. And so he was elected as the chairperson for the supporters club, for Nkana or Rokana Football Club. So, they were democratic. But of course, as I indicate in the paper, the more they got organized, and the more the mining companies started identifying themselves with the football clubs, the more political it was getting, because then they started, you know, influencing nearly or dictating nearly everything that was going on in the football clubs. And the only kind of independent stakeholders who could try to challenge and make the mining authorities accountable were the supporters. But then, of course, dynamics playing in there, it meant that the mining authorities, in a way as well, started wanting to influence as to who is elected to head these supporters clubs. And because initially the mines engaged and welcomed the supporters clubs, and even, you know, made them affiliated to the clubs, and were given voting rights. But as they saw that, well, these clubs are becoming so powerful and they're, you know, making them accountable, then they started kind of to start wanting to manipulate them, and then that's how they kind of disconnected them. So no, you know, you are no longer part of the football the club bodies, because, you know, you are causing trouble. So those are some of the dynamics that started going on. And of course, in some clubs, then where they would be, you know, politically clever mining officials, they would kind of, you know, doctor the elections or influence to make sure that, you know, people whom they could easily manipulate or control led these clubs kind of to neutralize them and make sure that they don't make the mining authorities and club executives, you know, as accountable as it was getting. So, but in terms of, you know, the broader evolving political atmosphere, I did not get clear connections as to kind of maybe broader roles that these supporters clubs played, for example, in district politics or moving out of sports, primarily their influence was within the football circles, and of course they could have had, you know, tacit, you know, influence in a way that as one of the chairpersons of the supporters club for Ron Antelope Football Club indicated to me that even mining general managers were kind of aware of the influence that the supporters had, and they would not want kind of to differ with them because then they might kind of, you know, talk negative of the general manager, and which might trickle up or go up to you know, to the national authorities and end up maybe firing the general manager. Or so everyone wanted to be in good light with the supporters club because they wanted, you know, to be projected as good people. So in a way, they played kind of a very influential political role that could, you know, in a way go beyond football clubs.
Thank you.
A kind of indirect influence, yes, perhaps, at this time.
Yes.
Kind of building on this point, actually, one of my favorite parts of the paper is talking about the punch-ups and the beer drinking and all the stuff that we often associate with rowdy young men at football grounds and occasionally also women.
Yes.
And I wanted to ask you, Gabor, how you went about analyzing crowds and particularly the dynamics of the crowds. How did you deal with these press reports? Did you come across any photographs or video or film about this? And did you get any sense of what the police surveillance or response or actions towards these fans were? Because it seems to me that this is complicating the colonial powers' job tremendously. On the one hand, they're pushing these welfare centers and trying to co-opt the masses through sport. On the other hand, they're creating the conditions for undermining law and order and sort of inciting rebellion in some respects, maybe you know, unintentionally, obviously. But it also points out these supporters clubs and these fans and these crowds that there's a lot of tension, that football is not just about unity and liberation from the British. It's also about rivalry. And sometimes it's, you know, geographical, territorial, neighborhood, class, etc. So how did you go about analyzing this work? And maybe how did you as a Zambian, you know, have sort of special skills and knowledge that you brought to the field that maybe someone from the United States or Europe might miss?
Well, that's a very good question. Of course, there were serious rivalries that emerged between these supporters groups. I think I hint a little in the paper, especially within each mining town. There was serious rivalry between, you know, football clubs from the mining area and those from the government, what were called government locations, which were, you know, which were predominantly run where civil servants and clerks, policemen, and domestic servants lived. So there was very serious rivalry within each town. So basically, each town had this internal rivalry. But of course, then the clubs between within each district, that is between the mining and the location areas, the non-mining areas, usually in terms of technical skills, and the mining clubs had an advantage, so they were domineering, and that's of course the reason why they were hated in terms of class issues, because they were seen to be doing very well and they were not well liked by the government supported clubs and communities which were in outside the mining townships. But then coming to the question as to how I kind of grappled to or how I tried to capture these experiences, of course, I got quite a lot of... I mean, in terms of law, there is some long-standing rivalries between these known rivalries between these clubs that I had an idea of that. I've heard people talking about them. And then I engaged, you know, supporters and former football players and other stakeholders involved in the running of different clubs to get an idea as to what really was sparking this rivalry and the histories behind the rivalries, etc. So oral interviews there played a very important role. And of course, maybe answering part of the question as to whether maybe there's what could have given me a better advantage in terms of analyzing these issues. The slight thing probably that could have only given me an advantage was the language, because I speak most of the languages spoken in the like on the Copper Belt. I did actually my high school on the Copper Belt at Roan Antelope Secondary School, which is in the mining area. So I experienced, you know, how it was kind of, although at a later time, to how it was to live in the mine and to experience the sulfur dioxide that was coming from the mining smelter. The center, yeah, popularly known as center. And I remember sometimes we'd be in class you know, these classes with broken windows. Then when the smelter releases the center, then the whole class, we are choked and we are coughing and, you know, and this is as late as the late 1990s when I was finishing my high school. So the language in terms of, you know, since I speak Bemba, which is the dominantly spoken language on the Copper Belt, you know, I could discuss with, you know, elderly people who went to these football matches. I had chats with some of the so-called hardcore supporters of, you know, different clubs and discussed with them in their language to get, you know, their experiences and the songs they sang and what those songs. And then, of course, since I understand the language, then I could kind of try to make sense of what those songs could have meant and how, you know, those songs could have been demonizing, you know, the other group based maybe because of, you know, they are less, you know, economically sound, or probably they are, you know, being counted as, you know, practicing a lot of magic, and their magic is finished now, so they cannot do anything, etc. So that is kind of how I tried to capture those experiences of, you know, of soccer fans and the mood that was going on around that time in this rivalry that was going on, especially amongst the between the major Copper Belt football clubs. And at that time, of course, as I hinted in my introduction, the Copper Belt had simply the best clubs in the country, in the whole country, until the mid-19, I discussed this in, of course, my other chapters, until the late 1960s or the mid-1960s and 1970s, when other parastatal corporations in Lusaka and the army and other government-related structures kind of also got into a serious football investment. I'm not sure if I answered.
Did you find any video, any film of games during this period? Because, I mean, in the United States and in Europe, there's lots and lots of film from the post-war period, and that allows you to say things and read into football in a particular way. Did you find any? Or do you know of any that's available?
No, unfortunately, I did not find any video sources or in all the archives. And I also had quite good connections with people who are involved in, who are either football journalists and but none of them kind of could give me any kind of, you know, videos of, you know, these football events. I tried to engage the Zambia National Broadcasting Corporation. Of course, they televised at least from the mid from the mid 1970s onwards. They televised national team football matches and continental football competitions, but they were
not this period.
Yeah, but not this period at all.
Okay, thank you, Andrew Guest, and then Chris Boltzmann. And feel free to add yourself to the queue on Skype.
Yeah, thank you, Chipani. This is a really fun thing to read, and impressed by the work. I really also enjoy the mix of the different sources. And I actually wanted to ask a little bit about the oral histories, both just because that sounds like fun, getting to talk to some of the stars of Zambian's past, but also sort of, it seems to me like the main argument you're trying to make here is that the football was brought in as an effort to kind of control and manage local populations, but that it actually got reshaped and that the local populations demonstrated agency around football, which makes a lot of sense. But I wonder, I guess I was a little curious if the people you talked to themselves saw it that way, how much awareness there was around it as a form of, you know, getting local control or local power. And at a more abstract level, how much of the broader process that was going on really was about local agency versus, it seems to me like the alternative is more of a kind of hegemonic process where the authorities are maintaining power by giving up little bits to the local communities and the local populations. And I you probably draw out the evidence for your argument more in the broader dissertation, but it strikes me as interesting and relevant even to, you know, I know obviously we've talked in the past about sports and development in contemporary Zambia and contemporary Malawi and other parts of Southern Africa, but that seems to me like one of the key questions. How much are these sports programs that are brought in externally really, how much are they essentially kind of neo-colonial, neo-imperialist effort versus how much room is there for genuine power to the kind of local communities?
Thank you for a very good question. Yes. going to the 1950s, especially the period the paper or the chapter is looking at, you are right. Maybe if I may just touch on the kind of the diffusion of the game in the Copper Belt and in Zambia as a whole. And I try to point out that actually, whilst the colonial and mining authorities wanted to introduce the game, you know, to control, actually the people had already appropriated the game and they had already, you know, started playing it in their communities and it was already kind of going on. So they just welcomed the move because they felt that, well, it is actually going to enhance, you know, the development of the game that we are interested in enjoying in our communities. So, but coming to the interesting question as to how the awareness that could have been in the local people in terms of, you know, how they turned it down and used it, you know, as a tool for kind of challenging colonial authorities I would say that, you know, the people, you know, and you mentioned if I had any experience or any feeling that, you know, the local people themselves were kind of aware of how they had started getting to use the game to challenge colonial authorities and their role of the game around that time. I think that yes and no. Yes, in the sense that I engaged, for example, I had a chat with people who were politically enlightened, academically, you know, educated. One of them I mentioned in the paper, Tom Tine. He's, I think, now in his late 80s or he's going towards his 90s. He was the first. I discuss him in the next chapter. He was the first black person to lead the National Football League, which was formed in 1962 when the racially segregated teams were, you know, when kind of amateur football was dissolved and professional football emerged. So he's the one who was kind of trusted to run this non-racial national football league. And at this time, it was 2 years before independence. So we were still deep in the colonial era. And of course, the waves of, you know, in terms of nationalist movements had started emerging. But he told me that, you know, people around this time were still buying through windows. They were not allowed to get through shops because of their skin color. So when he became, you know, the chairperson of the National Football League. So I engaged him and asked him, you know, the question that you just asked us, you know, how much awareness was there in terms of the development of the game and kind of this tacit political direction that it was taking. So he indicated to me that, well, people like him, for example, were well aware because he went, for example, he went to the same school with Kaunda, who later on became the first Republican president. So he was, for example, he hinted to me that he was very much aware of what was going on and the intentions of the colonial and mining authorities of using the game to control the people. And that they resisted. And he pointed out, and I think I caught him in the next chapter that I write, where he argues that actually the development of the game on the Copper Belt was spearheaded not by the mining authorities, but by the people themselves. And when the mining authorities saw that, well, there's a lot of enthusiasm in the game, that's when then they joined. And of course, as I indicate in terms of the formation of the committee that now was kind of, you know, assigned to control football. So amongst enlightened and politically conscious local people, I'm sure they were aware of the political dynamics and the political direction the game within football itself, the political direction the game was taking. But of course, other people on the ground, like, you know, some, you know, supporters, chairpersons of, you know, supporters groups that I had chats with, I don't think that they really paid attention to that. With them, their passion was, you know, enjoying the game and getting the best quality of the game on the pitch and their team winning matches and making sure that whoever is seen to be a hindrance to their team achieving the best results then should kind of be sorted out. So that is kind of the impression that I got. I'm not sure if I answered all your questions, Dr. Guest.
No, that's fine. That's great. It's very interesting. Please, I know there's other folks that want to ask questions, so I'll thank you.
Sure. Okay, we have about 15 minutes left. Chris Boltzmann has another question.
Because I'm not sure if people can hear me.
Yes.
You started to talk about segregation. I'm particularly interested in segregation in Zambian football. From my own research, of course, on South African football, I was very interested to see that the Castle Cup, of course, is sponsoring, or Castle Lager is sponsoring this cup competition. Of course, the South African multinational corporation. But as I understand, the Northern Rhodesian Football Association was also affiliated to the whites-only South African Football Association, FASA. Can you possibly talk a little bit more about the role of white organized football in Zambia, firstly in terms of segregation, and then secondly in terms of integration? Because as I also understand, is that the Northern Rhodesian Football Association actually affiliates to FIFA prior to independence, when it's essentially led by white officials. And when does integration of sorts take place then in Zambian football?
Well, that's a very good question, because it's actually I discussed this question in details in chapter 2, following the chapter on the Copper Belt. So in terms of the white or European football in Zambia, started getting organized as early as the early 1920s, with you know, the Broken Hill Football Association being formed, and then the Northern Rhodesia Football Association actually emerging towards the end of the 1920s with William Watson, a Broken Hill miner, as the president. So this one then was, of course, segregated. And then along the way, as you correctly indicated, then it got affiliated to the to SAFA, South African Football Association. And of course, the acts, you know, there were very, you know, racial, indicating that, you know, only, you know, people of European descent, only, you know, all affiliated associations should run football only for people with European descent. So, however, the Northern Rhodesia Football Association was flourishing and playing a lot of, you know, competitions of the Copper Belt, which we are now discussing. There was even what was called the Congo Border Football Association, which was an all-white or all-European football association that was running football in the Copper Belt. And because it was bordering Katanga region, where there was also a huge European community there, so they were playing football with, you know, the association included, you know, the Katanga teams in Belgium, Congo. So, however, moving towards towards the end of the 1940s, interracial football matches started emerging, and especially going towards the 1950s, more interracial football matches were emerging. But of course, these matches were not allowed by the Northern Rhodesia Football Association. So they seriously warned all the clubs that were affiliated to the Northern Rhodesia Football Association that, you know, participating in these interracial football association attracted disciplinary measures from the mother body. But informal interracial football matches went on until the beginning of the 1960s, when actually now some of the dynamics, I'm sure you are aware of the formation of the Federation of, you know, the Federation of Rhodesia and Nyasaland, when the three territories, Malawi, Zambia, and Zimbabwe, are brought together to form the Central African Federation. Now, around this time, then the politics were going on as to forming also kind of a federal sports association that would govern football within all the three territories. And now this is what sparked a very interesting development, because within the European community and the African, firstly, the Africans did not want the federation because they knew that it strengthened racial segregation, and it strengthened, it connected Northern Rhodesia with Southern Rhodesia, which was more racist, and then they really didn't want this federation. So in sports as well, they really opposed this move. But again, within the Northern Rhodesia Football Association, there were, you know, liberal members, Europeans, who were actually interested in interracial football matches, and that is where now interests of doing away with moving towards professionalism, leaving away amateur and kind of coming up with interracial, non-racial football league, which emerged in 1962. So that is how, kind of, you know, on both ends, with a lot of support from businessmen and interested football enthusiasts from the European communities and African communities that opposed the formation of this central, federation football association of a sort, that kind of led to the formation of a non-racial national football league, and that kind of then it meant towards that. And as you correctly put it, so when it became non-racial, when the non-racial football league was formed, led by Tom Chine, whom I mentioned, then Jimmy Fleming remained as chairperson, or was elected as chairperson. Firstly, it was Hayes, and then later handed over to Jim Fleming as chairperson of the Northern Rhodesia Football League. And that is when now kind of the Northern Rhodesia Football League qualified to affiliate to FIFA. I don't know if I touched on the questions the way you...
Absolutely. That's absolutely fascinating. But does that mean that when the English Football Association sent a side in 56 and Preston sent a side in 58 and Bolton sent a side in 59 to Northern Rhodesia, did they play against Europeans or did they play against the mixed Northern Rhodesian side? And what would the crowds have looked like too?
They played against European sides. There were interests of probably playing one or two local teams, but because they were coming under the Northern Rhodesia Football Association, and they were given rather by SAFA. I'm not sure of these visits because now I'm mixing the two, because there were other visits where a European football club would come under SAFA and then allocate. And then SAFA would allocate matches to be played by clubs in Northern Rhodesia and Southern Rhodesia. And Northern Rhodesia didn't really like this, because usually SAFA would never, you know, extend these tours to Northern Rhodesia. But I can't remember. I need to check my notes, my sources to see if those visits were under SAFA. Or they just came independently direct to the Northern Rhodesia Football Association. But when they came to the Northern Rhodesia Football Association, if I can remember correctly, I think they only played European clubs, because by then the non-racial National Football League was not yet. I mean, racial football had not yet been abandoned within the Northern Rhodesia Football League, within the Northern Rhodesia Football Association, because it was still affiliated to SAFA.
And here we're getting into the very, very messy institutional history of African football, particularly in areas with large white populations who were most often inimical to playing colorblind sport. So I'm sorry for the folks who are not so familiar with the African context. It can get pretty complicated. Who is next in line? Daniel had some questions about race and sport before independence and how this mixed sport is taking place. Would you like to ask that?
No. I just wanted to clarify that I understood the year right, 1962.
Mm-hmm.
But we had already now discussed here by chatting, so it's no open question.
Yeah, independence comes 2 years later, so there's already mixed football happening at the sort of semi-professional level. Okay, anyone else want to ask a question? We have about 5 minutes left. I guess I have a question for you, Igabo, that maybe someone else is interested to. Is you were in Zambia for a year and a half doing this research.
Yes.
How did the academics and journalists and even the people you interviewed, fans, former players, receive your work? You mentioned earlier in a funny comment you made that some of the academics were wondering why you came to America to do a doctoral dissertation on Zambian football.
That's right.
So can you tell us about how you were received and what that means maybe for these kinds of studies in a Central African, South Central African context?
Yes, sure. Thank you. I was actually received very, very well. With some of them, of course, with a lot of enthusiasm, because they are interested and they were impressed that somebody is doing his doctoral dissertation on football. And I created and connected and created very good relationships with a number of them, and they were even willing to go at length in terms of sharing a lot of sources and insights. And some of them even now, I have a question, I still make a call to some of them and ask, what do you think about it? So, do you remember what happened around this time? You know, so we share quite a lot. And of course, a few of them, who are a bit maybe, you know, protective, because maybe they're interested in writing their own book, on football, maybe they're a bit, you know, protective in terms of sharing information and sources, but and most of them were very, very happy, and I hope that I'm hoping that probably when I go back and start working from there, I can create a stronger relationship with them in terms of you know, benefiting. I can continue benefiting from, because they have enormous networks and sources on the ground, which I can explore and continue building my research on.
Excellent. There's a question following up here from Martha. Is there a sports study center or program at any of the universities in Zambia?
No, no, there's nothing at all.
You are it.
Sorry?
You are.
Yes, I'm it. Yes.
The program.
So when I go and, you know, I was trying to get a job there, although it's a bit complex. I hope they'll give me a job at some time. So I hope that probably if I got a job there, then I would look into, you know, developing a center of that kind. There are... the main university, which is in Lusaka, where I live, the University of Zambia, offers a little course in physical education, but they don't offer any courses in sports science or sports management or anything of that sort. So that is really a tragedy there, and primarily the main reason is because there are no qualified people who can actually handle those courses. So, I think if I'm right, I think there are only maybe two or so whom I know Zambians who have PhDs in sports studies, and both of them are two or three, and both of them are out of the country. They're in the UK. So, and that's why I really want to go there and settle, and hopefully in future we can have something as well. Of course, there are a lot of economic implications and obstacles, which I'm very much aware of. But I'm sure we can try to come up with something and through networks, etc.
Well, then on that hopeful note, I think we can bring this session to a close. There's some additional suggestions here from members. Thanks, everyone, for participating. And next month, date to be determined, but roughly in 4 weeks or thereabouts, Alex Galarza will present a paper on his doctoral work on the history of football clubs in Buenos Aires. So I hope you can all join us. And, yeah, let's stay in touch. Take care, everyone. Thank you.